You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For as long as Americans have been going to war, wounded veterans have returned, sometimes damaged physically, mentally, and emotionally. Yet how we've treated our injured veterans has varied over time, as after each war, Americans have vowed to not repeat the mistakes of the past. Well, my guest today says that that treatment symbolizes a dichotomy Americans have towards our disabled veterans, as we simultaneously experience a sense of adulation and revulsion towards them, which has expressed itself in major rehabilitation efforts over time, while society at the same time often figuratively tells those veterans to get over it and move on. In a day, today, when 95% of our physically wounded and traumatically stressed and brain-injured veterans are surviving and returning, we need to and are obligated to provide the best care and services. Yet have we learned enough from past wars? Well, my guest today has written about how we have dealt with injured veterans over history in his book, Paying With Their Bodies, American War and the Problem of Disabled Veterans. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. John Kinder is an assistant professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University. And in his book, he argues that American veterans are at the center of two competing visions of war, one that highlights the relative safety of U.S. military intervention overseas, the other indelibly associating American war with injury, mutilation, and suffering. John Kinder is my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. John Kinder, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
What led you to research and write about the history of how we have treated our wounded veterans over time?
I was initially interested in World War I, and I was trying to think of a way into the discussion or the history of World War I in America. There had been a lot of books written about British experiences in World War I, German experiences in World War I, and particularly the cultural history of World War I in those nations.
We are in the centennial of that.
Right, and that's why it's especially relevant today, I think. And I was sitting in grad school in my professor's office and thinking to myself, well, how can I talk about the United States experience in World War I? Because it seems to be overlooked in large part, particularly compared to these European countries. And I started thinking about ways in. And I thought, well, I can look at weapons. I can look at film. And then it struck me to think about disabled veterans, because one of the remarkable things about disabled veterans, and this really animates the book, is the fact that disabled veterans at various times in U.S. history have served both as pro-war symbols and as anti-war symbols. And I started seeing a lot of that around World War I, and that really piqued my interest. And
of course, you just have to look at the news today to see that still in effect, too.
Sure. Right. We're still struggling with how to make sense of disabled veterans, how to make sense of war wounds, who's responsible for them. And I really started seeing a lot of that taking place, a real sort of conversation or anxiety about that during World War I, and that's what led me to this topic.
Now, you begin the book with the story of Christian Bagge, or Baga.
Right.
Who was a wounded veteran in the Iraq War, or in the current wars. Who was given a Purple Heart and a high-level ceremony because he'd been equipped with these new prosthetics that allow you to run and things like that, blades. And of course, there was a photo op with then-President Bush jogging around the White House grounds. And you led with that story. Why is that story telling?
Well, I think that story is telling for two reasons. One, I think it embodies this, what I call in the book, a fantasy or a dream that disability can be overcome, that with enough technological know-how, with the best science, the best prosthetics, we can remove the long-term legacy of disability, particularly for American warfare. And it really sort of, it's a shining symbol of what that might look like. On the other hand, I think it speaks to this longer history of disabled veterans being used as political props. Into the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, one common thing that presidents often liked to do was invite disabled veterans to the White House, where they would be photographed. Sometimes they would have these spring picnics and so forth. And it was just another sign that not only this administration, but the nation cared for its disabled vets.
And not only would it be used in the sort of official, it would be used by anti-war groups too.
Sure. And that's why disabled veterans are such a powerful symbol, if you will, because all you have to do is really change the context and, you know, a symbol of national courage can become seen by many people as a symbol of loss and failed promises.
And that's one of the central themes of this book, that throughout our history, we've seen the promise of medical treatment and improving conditions on the battlefield as far as protection, that through technology and modern medicine, we can make the casualty of war, the physical and mental casualties of war, lessened or almost eliminated. That's the one pipe dream. And then the other is this idea that war is so horrific, it is so horrible on the body, the spirit, and the mind, that we should avoid it at all costs.
And that's really what excited me. These two ideas sort of battling it out over the course of 20th century and 21st century America. This is one of the things that most surprised me in doing research for the book, is just how persistent this dream of disability-free warfare is. I go back to World War I era and look at these progressive rehabilitationists who are eager to take disabled veterans and move them back into civilian society. And if you read them, their writings are filled with these phrases like the end of disability, or we're on the verge of a disability-free era in American war. I mean, they were so excited about technology and medicine and reconstructive surgery and all of these sort of things that were going to get rid of the problem of war disability. And you can see this same kind of mantra, this same sort of enthusiasm running throughout 20th century America. And you see this especially today if you watch news stories about disabled veterans. You know, one of the first things that you'll often see are these stories about these remarkable space-age prosthetics, right, with computer chips and advanced designs that were essentially better than you know, natural limbs. And so there's still this real belief that if we do enough, disability can be removed from the calculus of American warfare.
Of course, back to that photo op in 2006 with
right.
Christian Bagga, he was asked, is this better than your real legs? And he goes, no, I'd rather have my real legs.
And that's the other side, too. You know, this at the same time, as much as there's this enthusiasm for this disability-free warfare that we can overcome, you know, the problems of disability with technology, there's also this longing for the body and a real sense of loss that comes with war injury that's persistent and powerful.
And that story also points out another sort of dual theme that shows up throughout the book, which is how the American public and American opinion makers have related to these disabled veterans. On one hand, they're put up on a pedestal, mm-hmm. as Christian Bagga was in this ceremony at the White House and the photo op with the president on these new blade prosthetics. On the other hand, at his Purple Heart ceremony, the military brass asked him to wear long pants to cover up the prosthetics, and he actually said, no, I'm going to wear shorts so people can see this. And this is this other dual theme of how we put our veterans on a pedestal, and at the other time, we're reviled by their appearance, and a lot of times we tend to shunt them aside, and we have throughout history.
We have, and this is one thing, another thing that I try to show in the book. As much as we as a nation say that we love, we revere, we respect our disabled veterans, there's an equally long history of casting them aside when they seem to disrupt the story of war we want to tell. Whether that's a story of triumph, whether that's a story of quick recovery, of victory, disabled veterans are problems and were seen as problems because they didn't fit easily into narratives about, you know, U.S. triumph, right? I mean, disabled veterans are alive and they remain alive for decades on end. And If you talk to disabled veterans, they will say things about their injuries that don't quite fit with either what you expect or what you imagine a politician would expect them to say. You know, some are proud of their injuries. They want to show them off as kinds of, you know, red badges of courage. Others look at their injury and see political failures, or they see loss. They wonder what this was for. Why did I lose my limb? Why did I get this injury? You know, and so this is something that, again, interests me about disabled veterans, that they're such a difficult and unruly political prop because they always disrupt anyone who seeks to use them for their own political gain.
Now, throughout the book, you do refer to that as the, quote, capital problem of the disabled veteran. And you said you use this deliberately.
This is a term I didn't invent. This is the term that Americans around World War I started to use when they were talking about their broad sense of how disabled veterans might disrupt 20th century American society. To really understand this, you have to go back to the Civil War. It was a devastating conflict. After the war, Union veterans in particular were very politically powerful. They were able to mobilize. They were able to win great concessions in Congress so that by the end of the 19th century, the United States was spending roughly 40% of its budget on pensions and soldiers' homes for about 900,000 Union veterans. Okay, and so by the time World War
I... Let's stop that for a second. 40% of the federal budget was being used for pensions and funding old veterans' homes?
It really is a remarkable figure.
Now, we have to remember the government was a lot smaller prior
to
World War
I. That's one thing that we have to remember. But nevertheless, this...
But still, that's a remarkable figure.
It, on the one hand, it's a sign of just how powerful veterans groups were. It's a sign of really how veterans were able to carve out a privileged position for themselves within American society.
Really, when you think about it, though, every president from Grant on after the Civil War veterans, practically. Maybe Grover Cleveland might have been the outlier, but nearly all of them were Union veterans.
Right, and this was important to their appeal, and this is important to their claims of martial citizenship. It's the idea that I fought when my country called. I put my body on the line, and now the United States has an obligation to me in my suffering, in my old age. This is a powerful argument. But by the 20th century, many Americans began to look around and say, well, this is incredibly expensive. We are entombing, and this was the term, entombing these men to old soldiers' homes. They're not productive members of society. They're living in the past. What we need to do is, and if we do this again, we're going to be bankrupted morally and financially. So
was there also sort of a progressive idea of the fact that you have a whole couple of generations with no safety net whatsoever? Was that entering into the thinking as well?
In what sense?
Well, by the 1900, you know, you have, you know, the slums and the workhouses and everything, you know, child labor and all this sort of stuff. Yet there are very little, just beginning to see protections in those various areas.
Well, that's part of it. Progressives were deeply interested in disabled veterans because they saw them as yet another problem population that needed solving, just like the poor, just like the uneducated. They thought that this is a population that is essentially a negative force in America. And so what they wanted to do was, rather than take the next generation of disabled veterans and give them pensions and put them into old soldiers' homes, they would come up with a new way to solve this problem of the disabled veteran. This was their term. And that their solution was rehabilitation. And that's one of the reasons why I focus so much of the book on World War I. World War I is when we see the growth of rehabilitation and the United States veterans policy going all in on rehabilitation is going to be our core philosophy toward how to deal with disabled veterans going forward. And rehabilitation for its time was remarkable. It said that these people who in the past would be sort of exiled to the outskirts of society, would now be reintegrated as independent workers. They would be physically reconstructed and they would be vocationally trained so that at the end of their time, they would, in essence, lose their disabilities. They might be physically injured still, but in terms of their social position, in terms of their economic viability, they would be just like everyone else.
At least that was the theory.
That was the theory. It didn't work, but this was part of the dream that, well, next time by World War II, we've tweaked it. We've managed to fix all of the things that went wrong. And so now we're going to do it again. And this is the essence of, you know, disabled veterans policy today. Rehabilitation is the backbone.
My guest today is John Kinder. He is an assistant professor of American Studies and History at the Oklahoma State University, and he is the author of Paying with Their Bodies, American War and the Problem of the Disabled Veteran. It's published by the University of Chicago Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the other byproduct of rehabilitation is a notion that has also fallen through history, which is get on with your life, forget what happened, and move on. And that's also a very strong sort of American trait after wars that, okay, the war's over, move on, forget about it. And, of course, that totally neglects the mental health side of being a veteran.
Exactly. And this is one thing that I think is very striking about the American culture of war, which is this urge toward what was called in World War I de-veteranization. These same rehabilitationists did not want you to linger in the past. They were critical of veterans groups. They didn't want the public to treat veterans any differently than anyone else. Right? They wanted them to be seen as normal. The problem was, of course, for disabled veterans, they did not see themselves as normal. They found themselves always at some level caught up in the past because they were injured, right? They were permanently disabled, right? They could not leave the war behind them.
Yeah, even if they were not physically disabled, they were traumatically disabled in many ways.
And that's one thing I try to emphasize in the book, again, is that most disabled veterans do not look like amputees. The amputees are rare. They are overrepresented in American visual culture when it comes to veterans. Most disabled veterans in World War I and today look just like everyone else. They have what are called invisible injuries. Today it's PTSI, post-traumatic stress injury, which used to be called post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injury, or moral injury, but any kind of mental trauma. But, you know, they really struggle with this idea that, you know, they are expected to move on. Well, what if your body, your mind won't allow that? You know, you become a figure that many people want to push aside because you have not moved on, because of a willingness, a desire to move on as a nation.
You mentioned World War I as being the focal point, and certainly this is where this veterans policy, really disabled veterans policy, begins put into place. When they were rehabilitating, were they mainly rehabilitating physical wounds? You know, for many, it was gassing, which was a long-term disability. You're not going to move on after, if you're gassed, you might have some degree of limited, ability. But for many of them, it was like 5, 6, 7 years and boom, they're dead because this is a long-term effects.
Sure. And a lot of these vocational programs would go on for 3, 4, 5, 6 years. But part of the reason that it did not work for most people was because simply that if you had the effects of gassing you and tuberculosis and other kinds of things, in the end, you would wind up with that pension, maybe in a government hospital and so forth. And your life was not markedly improved. Right? But this led to a great deal of concern among disabled veterans in particular that rehabilitation was sort of a way to kind of make them disappear, that it, you know, they were putting them through all these classes, through all these programs, when really what they needed was rest. And they're trying to fix problems that could not be fixed. And so this led to a good deal of skepticism, particularly on the behalf of the American Legion and the disabled American veterans, which forms after World War I and becomes a real voice critical of the government and its efforts to help disabled veterans, right? They want to stand up and really challenge the idea that they are made to be disappeared, you know, and they are meant to fade away.
You know, it's interesting. It sounds like those veterans viewed rehabilitation in many of the ways outsiders have viewed the old soldiers' homes, which was a way of shunting these veterans aside out of society where they were sort of cloistered among themselves.
Sure.
And then this is another trend of this sort of adoration and revile sense.
And this is a funny irony because disabled veterans, you know, one place where they would actually gain power was by meeting other disabled veterans. And the place they did that was in rehabilitation, you know. And so rehabilitation actually helped spawn, for example, the disabled American veterans. But disabled American veterans and a lot of disabled veterans groups really did not trust much of the public. They believed that the public would forget them. They believed that larger veterans groups would ignore them, that the government would cheat them, and thus they needed to establish their own political force, you know, their own political organizations, right? If they hoped to be safe in the 20th century.
That probably manifested itself greatest in the first years of the Depression when the Bonus Army marches on Washington.
Right. The Bonus Army is a remarkable incident. And people often talk about the Bonus Army and they use it as a sort of precursor to the Depression and or the rise of the New Deal. What I found in my research was that if you look at the way that the Bonus Army presented themselves, they often presented themselves as disabled veterans. Right. They would sometimes dress up like disabled veterans. They would, you know, walk on canes. They would hide their arms. They would limp along. They would talk about paying with their bodies and so forth. And they were making a claim that they were not like the rest of Depression-era America. They had already suffered. And it was incumbent upon the United States to give them what they deserved. Hoover disagreed, FDR disagreed, but in the end, disabled veterans and veterans overall prevailed. And what's interesting about this moment is that in some ways, it's a precursor to the GI Bill, because the GI Bill essentially extends many of the benefits of rehabilitation to all veterans. So it's essentially saying that everyone who goes off to war at some level comes back disabled. Right. And so it doesn't matter whether you are physically disabled or invisibly disabled, right? Military service in itself is a kind of disability. And this argument would be made throughout the 20th century.
My guest today, John Kinder, Assistant Professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University and the author of Paying With Their Bodies, American War and the Problem of the Disabled Veteran. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Well, in subsequent wars, we seem to do a better job at treating the physical injuries, but the invisible injuries, as you mentioned, I know after World War II, it was the same sort of thing. Get on with your life, that the war is over. We're going to give you this great GI Bill. Move on. And most tragically, in a conflict like Vietnam, where literally a whole generation of traumatized soldiers were left pretty much on their own. Now we know the mental tolls of battle and the mental tolls of trauma. Do you see anything different with today's veterans?
I think a distinction needs to be made between the experiences of disabled veterans themselves and the way the culture responds to them. I essentially make an argument in the book that after World War II, there was not this mass anxiety about the disabled veteran, in part because the war went so much better, right? In a quote-unquote good war, there was a genuine sense that these sacrifices, this bodily injury, was somehow worth it.
And also there was a sense that the society as a whole sacrificed because of rationing, because
right.
of the war, the home front, perhaps. So there was that sense, I think, of
right.
of move on, that's over.
Right. And more people were sort of encouraged to see this as a norm. But when wars go badly, you know, this is when we see a great deal of reflection upon why we fought this war, what are our obligations to the injured, you know, how will this go on? And that's sort of what I see today. I mean, we're in a fascinating moment where roughly 95% of those injured in Afghanistan and Iraq survive their injuries, right? So we have more and more people surviving wounds that would have been deadly even in the Vietnam era. On the other hand, we are so divorced from military culture in the United States, right? So few people fight. It's such a tiny percentage of the United States population that, you know, it's easy to overlook them. It's easy to let them pass by. And it's easy to assume that, well, we have this problem fixed. You know, we're able to save 95% of them. You know, surely we're able to do help all of those, you know, who have mental disabilities or suffering from mental trauma. But that simply isn't the case. In fact, this distance or this gap between the kind of broad mainstream America and this military culture makes it easier for disabled veterans to fall through the cracks. It makes it easier for disabled veterans to be lumped in with other problem populations, other problem groups. It's easier to see them as disposable, as dangerous figures. Right now in the United States, roughly 22 veterans kill themselves every day. I mean, we're talking about more American veterans or more American soldiers killing themselves than were killed by soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, it's a real national tragedy. And I think it stems from both ignorance, but also we now have a military structure which makes veterans disposable, both for the military and for American culture overall. And, you know, what I wanted to do in the book was try to help show the roots of that, explain how, on the one hand, we can wave our flags and go out to our parades, and so many millions of Americans can say sincerely, right, I love the troops, I support the troops, and yet at the same time, we have, you know, growing rates of homelessness and poverty and suicide, right? How do we explain this gap? Well, in part, it's because of our unwillingness to take seriously this long brewing issue.
And the problem of the disabled veteran remains.
Yes, and will remain, some would say, until the U.S. radically changes its foreign policy.
John Kinder, I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
It was great to be here.
John Kinder is an assistant professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University and the author of Paying With Their Bodies, American War and the Problem of the Disabled Veteran. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.